From feature story news in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, the F word. The Senate votes in favour of the so-called filibuster nuclear option.
The American people have probably never been more frustrated with Washington. Over the past 5 years, we've seen an unprecedented pattern of obstruction in Congress that's prevented too much of the American people's business from getting done.
We hear from Pakistan after a deadly U.S. drone strike reignites anger over the controversial policy. Also today, we speak to the Methodist minister who was suspended for officiating his son's same-sex marriage.
Was it worth it? Absolutely. For the love of my son, I would never do anything else.
And we're in London, where Chinese betting shops are threatening the capital's heritage. That's coming up on FSN Reports, after a summary of our latest news headlines.
From feature story news in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. President Obama has promised that the U.S. military will not conduct raids on Afghan homes except under extraordinary circumstances. In a letter to the Afghan President Hamid Karzai, he said that the U.S. will continue to respect Afghan sovereignty. It's part of a new security agreement being discussed by a council of elders in Kabul. Kate Fisher reports from Washington.
The letter came as President Karzai urged the 2,000 elders in the Loya Jirga to back the security deal. It would clear the way for thousands of U.S. troops to train and assist Afghan forces after the combat mission ends next year. But President Karzai says even if it's approved by the elders, it should not be signed until after a new leader is elected in polls next spring. Kate Fisher, Washington.
Three women have been rescued from a house in South London after allegedly being held as slaves for at least 30 years. Two suspects, a man and a woman, both aged 67, were arrested early on Thursday morning by specialist police. Our correspondent Ollie Barrett has more from the Metropolitan Police Headquarters in Scotland Yard.
Police say they were contacted by one of the women last month, and the women were rescued from this house in October, but it was only earlier today that the arrests of the man and the woman in their 60s were made. Police here in London say they have never seen anything like this before. They believe that the women's lives were greatly controlled and largely that they were kept within the premises. They believe that the premises was residential, and they describe the conditions they were kept under as domestic servitude.
Iran is increasing its demands ahead of a new round of negotiations aimed at curtailing its nuclear program. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is calling the talks in Geneva the best chance in a decade to resolve the issue. From Washington, Daniel Wrenches reports.
The five permanent members of the Security Council plus Germany, the P5+1, want to eliminate Iran's growing capability to produce nuclear weapons and hope to cut a deal within 6 months. Whilst they negotiate, they're trying to reach an interim arrangement in which Iran agrees to freeze its enrichment activities in exchange for some modest easing of sanctions. In Washington, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is hopeful.
We have the best chance we've had in a decade, we believe, to halt progress and roll back Iran's program.
But Iran's now demanding a more robust easing of oil and banking sanctions, something that members of the P5+1 group would be reluctant to agree upon because it risks taking away their main negotiating leverage to reach a comprehensive deal later on. Daniel Wrenches, Washington.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. French police have named the man they suspect of carrying out two shootings and a carjacking in Paris on Monday. Abdelhakim Dakar, who was also involved in a series of shootings in the 1990s, was taken into custody on Wednesday evening. Kate Moody has the latest from Paris.
48-year-old Abdelhakim Dakar was arrested in an underground parking lot in a western suburb just outside the French capital on Wednesday evening. He's been hospitalized and had apparently ingested a large amount of drugs. Reports also suggest he was carrying a rambling letter which complains about social problems in France and the conflict in Syria. DNA samples have matched him to some of the crime scenes in Monday's shooting spree, during which he critically injured a photographer's assistant at a newspaper office, opened fire outside a bank, and hijacked a car. Dakar previously spent 4 years in prison for his role in the Maupin-Ray affair in 1994. He was convicted of buying the gun used by student Florence Ray and her lover Audrey Maupin, in which three police officers and a taxi driver were killed. Dekar claimed at the time that he'd been hired by the Algerian secret services to infiltrate the French far left, with which Ray and Maupin were involved.
Elsewhere, Ukraine's government has frozen talks with the European Union over a major free trade and cooperation deal. That means the deal between Kiev and Brussels will most likely not be signed in the next few days, as was expected. It comes after months of wrangling about whether Ukraine's future should lay east with the former Soviet Union or move west towards Europe. And the number of Americans filing new unemployment claims has dropped, suggesting an improving jobs market. The latest figure is almost double expectations and near pre-recession levels. New York, California, Pennsylvania, and Michigan reported the largest drops. And that's the latest Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports.
The vote today, I think, is an indication that a majority of senators believe, as I believe, that enough is enough. The American people's business is far too important to keep falling prey day after day to Washington politics.
President Obama backing the Senate's decision to pass the so-called filibuster nuclear option. Earlier today, Senate Democrats fulfilled a long-standing threat to change the procedural rules for confirming the president's nominees. Many lawmakers and government watchdogs hope the move will end the pattern of Republicans blocking most of President Obama's candidates for the government's important courts and agencies. But others warn the nuclear option tactic could come back to bite Democrats if they ever lose control of the Senate. On Capitol Hill, Alice Olstein has the story.
Following the recent filibustering of a number of the president's nominees for the second highest court in the country, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid took the floor Thursday for a major announcement.
The American people believe Congress is broken. The American people believe the Senate is broken. And I believe the American people are right. The need for change is so very obvious.
Citing the Republican minority's efforts to block President Obama's candidates to lead the Defense Department, CIA, Environmental Protection Agency, Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and the Federal Housing Finance Agency, among other positions, Reid proposed a measure to allow most presidential nominees to receive an up or down majority rules vote.
It's time to get the Senate working again, not for the good of the current Democratic majority or some future Republican majority, but for the good of the United States of America. It's time to change.
The rule change, which passed 52-48 on Thursday, does not apply to Supreme Court nominees or any legislation. But it does apply no matter who is in the White House making those appointments. Many Republicans, including Utah's Orrin Hatch, warned that if their party retakes the Senate and the White House in the future, they could use this new rule to give extremely conservative judges lifetime appointments. Hatch wondered if Democrats who voted for the so-called nuclear option considered this possibility.
Yeah, they've got too many people over there who've never been a minority. And they're rustling their inexperienced feathers. And frankly, it's a very dangerous thing for them to do. And they're, like I say, they're going to rue the day they do it.
But advocates of filibuster reform, including Oregon Democrat Jeff Merkley, say this will help the Senate move forward with robust debates on all nominees, no matter who's in office. Following today's historic rule change, he says he'll continue to push for further reforms.
We need to get rid of the filibuster on motion to proceed. We can't even get on to important legislation. I've advocated we should get rid of the filibuster on conference committees. We spent 6 months trying to start a budget conference committee, and we're unable to do so because of this. I've argued that we should have not 60 votes to end debate, but 41 to extend debate, and that of those 41, at least one should thereafter have to be on the floor making arguments so that we have, instead of this silent paralysis, we have a talking filibuster. That is the tradition of the Senate, that if you want to delay things, you would take the floor and you would make your case before the American people. That is a tradition we should restore. Then the American people can judge whether or not the folks who are slowing down the Senate on legislation are heroes or bums.
It's not often an obscure procedural change like this gets so much attention. Derailing planned meetings Thursday on NSA surveillance and the National Defense Authorization Act, and garnering a televised statement from the president. But it makes sense to Stephen Spaulding with the political watchdog organization Common Cause, who says it's about making sure those elected by the American people have a chance to govern and represent them.
That's how democracy operates. When the American people elect a Congress and a president, they elect new officers of government who are able to put forward nominees. This does not mean that anybody that the president nominates automatically is appointed. It just means the Senate can actually vote up or down, yes or no.
Following the historic shift in the Senate's rules, Majority Leader Reid immediately began bringing back a number of the president's stalled nominees for debate and a vote, beginning with several candidates chosen to sit on the second most powerful court in the country.
The D.C. Circuit is supposed to have 11 judges. It currently has 8 judges. There's been 3 vacancies that have been languishing for years.
If President Obama successfully fills the vacancies on that court, it will help protect his most significant policies, from health care reform to carbon emissions limits, from being struck down. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
This is FSN Reports. A U.S. drone attack in Pakistan is threatening to reignite tension over the controversial U.S. military policy. Pakistan reports say the strike killed 6 people, including a senior Taliban member. The target, in a populated area of the country's north, was the first used outside of the more volatile tribal regions of Waziristan. Earlier, I spoke to Islamabad-based journalist Annabel Symington.
Yes, there was a U.S. drone strike that hit a madrasa in northwest Pakistan in Hangu district in Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province this morning at about 4 a.m. Now, this is the first U.S. drone strike to strike within what is settled Pakistan, as opposed to the federally administered tribal areas, which are a semi-autonomous tribal region that runs along the border with Afghanistan and remains the sort of the main center of militant activity in Pakistan. Now, Hangu district in Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province does border the tribal areas. It is very close to the tribal areas. But the fact that this drone strike did take place in what is an area that's actually under the control of the central government has really lent even more impetus to this very virulent anti-drone lobby within Pakistan.
One of the figureheads of that anti-drone movement is the former international cricketer Imran Khan, who governs the area that was actually affected by this latest drone strike.
Yes, that's right. So Imran Khan's Pakistan Tehreek Insaf Party are the government of Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province. Now, he has always been staunchly anti-drone, but his sort of campaign really took on a new force after the drone strike at the beginning of this month that killed the Pakistani Taliban leader Hakimullah Massoud. He has said that he will block the NATO supply lines. So he was already planning a big rally for Saturday in Peshawar, which is the provincial capital of Khyber Pakhtunkhwa, in order to protest against these U.S. drone strikes, which he consistently describes as an attack on Pakistani sovereignty. And now with this attack, once again, he's gone on the offensive. He's actually even denied that 5 members of the Haqqani Network, who are an Afghan insurgent group who have close links to al-Qaeda and also to the Pakistani Taliban, that he's even denied that any of these key commanders were killed today and has said that it was just children who were killed. Now, I have sources on the ground who have confirmed that these were Haqqani leaders who were killed. But it just sort of shows you part of the huge misinformation campaign that goes on within the press and the debates that are raging within Pakistan, which really do just consistently lambast the U.S. for their drone policy, as opposed to looking at any good that could come out of killing some of these militant leaders.
Annabel Symington in Islamabad. The US drone policy has been publicly criticised by Pakistan over the number of civilian casualties caught up in the strikes. Although behind closed doors, it's thought the campaign is broadly supported by the Pakistani authorities. Earlier, Washington correspondent Daniel Rencher spoke to Kathy Kelly, coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence, about what this latest attack says about the direction of the US drone directive.
Pakistan is supposed to be an ally of the United States. Certainly creates the question of whether or not the Pakistani government is going to assert sovereignty and its responsibility to advocate on behalf of their own people when belligerent attacks happen across their borders. Also, federally administrated tribal areas are very isolated, and sometimes even the governors in those areas, the Pakistani governors, had to call journalists and outside the area. One in Peshawar told me he'd sometimes get calls asking, do you know what happened? Have you got any information or details? But when you go beyond those areas, certainly is a lively conduct of news reporting and journalism in Pakistan. So one could hope that the many people in Pakistan who are opposed to the drone attacks will rise to the occasion and vigorously question this.
President Obama has been somebody who said that he wants to bring troops away from the Middle East and be less interventionist, but at the same time points out that there's a responsibility to ensure America's security. So there is an argument to be made for using drone attacks, because although they are not always precise and there are collateral damage, absolutely, and that can't be played down, nonetheless, it's a better option, isn't it, than invading a country?
Well, let's think a moment about the option of exploring security based on fairness and even compassion, and becoming a beloved country all around the world rather than a country that's feared. I think we would find far more security if people looked to the United States as a country they could trust or that they could even rely on. So I think we get manipulated by this idea of terror and security for U.S. people, and we end up doing things that jeopardize our own security. I mean, even General Stanley McChrystal said that in January of 2013. He said that the arrogance of the drone attacks jeopardizes U.S. security.
Daniel Wrenches speaking to peace activist Kathy Kelly. Community leaders in London's Chinatown say the high number of betting shops opening are devaluing the area, leaving many locals in despair. It's feared the town in the heart of London's Soho district is losing its cultural heritage because of the number of betting shop licenses being approved. But industry leaders say they are only providing a service because of the high demand. Our UK correspondent Dan Whitehead has the story.
At the Chinese Community Centre in London, Chinese heritage and culture is alive and well, with dozens of elderly members meeting here every day. Many remember when restaurants began opening in London's Chinatown, feeding British soldiers in the 1950s who were returning from the Far East and had picked up an appetite for Chinese cuisine. Restaurants remain, but there is concern some are being forced out by an increasing number of betting shops taking over the main street. 9 have opened in the area, with other applications in the pipeline, and community leaders are worried about the effect on locals.
Over the years, we heard numerous, you know, true stories of family being totally destroyed, very hard-earned business ruined completely.
Christine Yao, who runs the community centre, has written to MPs and London's Mayor Boris Johnson about her concerns. Some betting shops in Chinatown are open until midnight, welcoming Chinese finishing work in the local restaurants. The industry says it is simply providing a service where there is demand and does not target specific areas. But Dirk Hansen, the chief executive of GamCare, a charity which offers help to people addicted to gambling, says they are seeing problems within the Chinese community.
We've traditionally served the Chinese community. We do it through local partnerships and Chinese language and so on. And through the community leaders that have spoken to us, even recently, business leaders, religious leaders, cultural leaders, political leaders, have all said they want to be able to limit the betting shops, but also have very, very strong concerns about the amount of gambling that's going on in the community.
Westminster City Council, which is in charge of handing out licences to bookmakers, is investing in research to better understand the impact of multiple betting shops in close proximity. Audrey Lewis is chair of the licensing committee and insists the issue is being tackled.
We've actually turned some applications to open later down and then lost on appeal. So it isn't that we haven't been taking it very seriously, but we have to have evidence. Everything we do on licensing has to depend on proper evidence. That's what the law says.
Back at the community centre, Christine Yao wants action now and not later, saying the damage is already being done.
On a good day, if they win some money, fine, you know, everybody happy. On a very bad day, when they go home, where's the money, you know, for food? Where's the money for the necessary soap, you know, toothpaste, things like that? Of course, there's going to be argument, and then create a lot of other problems. And of course, because of that problem, they tend to stay away. Where do they go? Of course, they go to betting shops.
But with demand for betting shops so high, the fight between them and the community looks set to continue for some time. Dan Whitehead, London.
Officials at the United Nations say after years of violent atrocities, the Lord's Resistance Army and its notorious leader, Joseph Kony, are gradually losing strength. Political instability in Central Africa has helped the rebel organisation, but despite the difficult conditions, African Union troops are slowly closing in on the LRA. Nick Harper reports from the UN headquarters in New York.
The United Nations estimates in the 25 years it's been operating, the Lord's Resistance Army has abducted more than 66,000 children and killed more than 100,000 people. Briefing the Security Council on the situation in Central Africa, the head of the UN Regional Office, Abu Musa, said recent regional instability had helped the rebel organisation.
The group remains a serious and unpredictable threat to communities throughout the sub-region.
But he said the 3,000 African Union soldiers tasked with hunting down the LRA had made good inroads.
Regional task force contingents are now fully operational. Military operations have degraded the LRA and limited it to pursuing survival tactics.
The 2012 video about the LRA's leader, Joseph Kony, brought him to the attention of the wider world, with the video viewed online more than 98 million times. He formed the Lord's Resistance Army in the late 1980s, proclaiming himself as a prophet with the aim of overthrowing Uganda's government. Since then, driven out of Uganda, the LRA has continued its reign of terror in the remote regions of Sudan, South Sudan, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and the Central African Republic. But with the LRA currently comprising of just 500 people, the feeling is now it's the time to finish the job of destroying the organisation. As the UN alternate representative of the US, Ambassador Jeffrey De Laurentiis, explains.
We are in the midst of a pivotal moment in the Central African region. We have a real opportunity to save countless lives and help to usher this region toward the stability and prosperity that its people deserve.
But instability in the Central African Republic has complicated the search for Kony. The rebels who ousted the government in the recent coup temporarily banned the African Union troops who are searching for the LRA. The American anti-LRA organization, the Resolve LRA Crisis Initiative, is trying to end the atrocities. But founder Michael Puffenberger admits the countries where the LRA operates have more immediate, pressing problems to deal with.
In Congo, we've seen the upheaval in the Kivus. In Central African Republic, we had a recent coup there that overthrew the government. And in Sudan and South Sudan, you have ongoing border tensions. So it's very difficult to maintain a level of political attention and resources towards these areas when it's not threatening the states themselves, it's only threatening civilians.
And as Puffenberger explains, the U.S. government is helping, but progress is slow.
We've sent about 100 U.S. military advisors who are out there working with their African Union partners, and they've been out there now for 2 years. And I think they found that the problem is harder than they anticipated. Working in this region is extremely difficult and complex.
But the tide could now be turning. There are rumors Kony is ill, and the number of fighters defecting from the LRA is increasing. The new CAR president, Michael Jatodia, is also said to be in communication with him, as the African Union envoy on the LRA, Francisco Madeira, told reporters.
He has tried, has been in contact with Mr. Kony, has his people have been in contact with him, and that they wanted to entice, to encourage him to surrender. Definitely he's no longer in peace and is feeling the pinch.
But for now, the abductions and atrocities continue, and Joseph Kony is no nearer to being found. His exact location is not known, And the African Union and United Nations admit he could be hiding anywhere within four different countries. Nick Harper, New York.
Now, a Methodist pastor who has been suspended from ministerial duties after he officiated at his son's same-sex wedding says he hopes to bring about a change in the church. Reverend Frank Schaefer from Pennsylvania was suspended for 30 days by a jury of fellow pastors. If after that he refuses to change his position, he will be defrocked. He told FSN's Kate Fisher that despite the risks, he could never put the church before his son.
I have my convictions and I acted upon my conscience. I followed my heart, and this is what I believe and what I stand for. Was it worth it? Absolutely. For the love of my son, I would never do anything else.
It does seem a church that promotes loving your neighbor and treating everybody with respect, that this kind of attitude, this kind of policy, just doesn't quite sit right.
I absolutely agree. It's kind of ironic that this was over an act of love. You know, when I agreed to officiate at my son's wedding, it was really an act of love, and this act of love forced me to choose between the love of my son and the love of my career, my church, and of course I chose my son, even though that was in some sense a difficult decision, and I was at the time aware of the fact that I might lose my career over this.
Do you think that through your courage, it may lead others to do a similar thing and perhaps you could begin to bring about change within the church?
I think so. I have to tell you this. I was so nervous and so scared before I took that witness stand. When I started, all of a sudden, I felt the prayers of the people. I felt a strength that I didn't expect to have. At that moment when I looked at them and said, look, if I'm going to be a United Methodist pastor tomorrow, I want you to know that I will not refuse ministry to anybody. And I told them that I would no longer be a silent supporter of my children, but that I would be an advocate.
Do you have any hope that you may be able to both be a minister and hold those views?
That's an interesting question. That's actually what I'm pondering right now. I have to say that I have a very strong sense of calling from God, so I'm sure that I will be in ministry in some form beyond those 30 days. It's just very hard to predict where that path is taking me. I would like to make an appeal to all parents that have gay children. I have three gay children, and know what that's like, and it's not easy. You know, I myself have had quite the journey where I had a conversion experience, you know, toward an acceptance of my gay children. I would ask them to please just love them as they are, because you have no idea what our children are going through that are struggling with their sexual orientation. They need a lot of love and affirmation. Don't push your children away. Love them and accept them. They are your flesh and blood.
FSN's Kate Fisher talking to Pastor Frank Schaefer. And that's the Thursday edition of FSN Reports. You can always get in touch with us by emailing us at reports@featurestory.com. You can also follow us on Twitter. We're there, at Feature Story. Coming up on Friday, we mark 50 years since the assassination of JFK. That's Friday, but for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Kate Fisher and Rebecca Foster on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone with Feature Story News everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.